Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Really pleased to present Don live this time. He was giving the keynote in the morning with the video, but now we have a chance to get another presentation about connectivism in practice, how they've been organizing teaching and courses. I assume that's what Steve will be talking about. And there will be time for discussion as well. For Stephen Downs in Canada, I could tell you that we have about 20 people in the room. I'm sure they know quite a lot of your work already, so you don't need to get into basics in that. But I'm really pleased that we could organize this anyway, this way, with the video keynote and now with the Skype video. So Steve, please. Now,
okay.
Okay,
well, thank you very much, and I take it you can hear me just fine. Looking at the video, it appears that there is some lag between when I speak and when you see me. There's a good 15 seconds lag, it would appear. Okay, so our method for advancing the slides might be interesting. So as Timu said, I'll talk for about 20 minutes, give or take, mostly give, and then we'll have some time for conversation and questions. So what I want to do today is to talk about a course that Rita Kopp, my colleague here in Moncton, and I are putting on. We'll be putting it on in June. Back when I originally proposed to do this talk, I thought the course would have been offered and done by now, but it hasn't been. So we're still in the planning stages. Nonetheless, there's still some worthwhile material. The name of the course is Critical Literacies. And we're doing a twofold thing here with this course. First of all, of course, we're testing once again the connectivist mode of offering learning materials online. And secondly, what we're also doing is talking about what we believe are the essential literacies that students require, that learners require, in order to be successful in a connectivist environment. And together, these two things address the question of whether it is possible to bootstrap these literacies. That is to say, whether we can use the connectivist model of teaching in order to enable students to acquire the skill sets that they require in order to participate effectively in a connectivist model of learning. Now, to advance these slides, I have my trusty water bottle here in honor of Earth Day, so be sure to revise, remix, redistribute, you know what I mean. Basically I'll be hitting it with a little bell when I want to advance a slide. So on to the next slide, which is connectivism. I know that people are familiar with what I've talked about before in the area of connectivism. At its heart, connectivism is the thesis that knowledge is distributed across a network of connections, and therefore that learning consists of the ability to traverse and construct those networks. What that works out to in practice is a course that is distributed across a network of connections that may be distributed across a set of different resources. Now I'm on the course components slide. One of the things that George Siemens and I did when we first started doing connectivist courses online is we also adopted what was very important, we felt, was open enrollment to the course. And the idea here is, instead of limiting a course to a small, closed group of people, the idea is to open it and to make the materials available to the largest group possible. We've done this in the Connectivism course, and Attractivist is well known by now, about 2,200 people. This phenomenon seems to continue. David Cormier and George Siemens are currently offering a course right now, in fact, as I speak, on the future of learning, and they've attracted more than 500 participants. So these courses tend to be massive courses, as well as distributed courses, and I think one goes in hand with the other. In our course online, like the Connectivism course, we're using the wiki as the means to offer the central structure of the course. The reason why we use the wiki is because the structure of the course is nothing more than a proposal, and the idea is that people who are interested in the course can add their own structure, change the structure, add resources, etc. In practice, people tend to simply follow what is there on the wiki, although I think that over time, as people feel more empowered by this sort of course, they are more likely to take the shape of the course into their own hands. As with the Connectivism course, in the Critical Literacies course, we're supporting the course with a blog. The blog is Rita's and my way, not simply of presenting content into the course environment, but also modeling and demonstrating the sort of course behaviors we would request of the people who are taking part in the course. The idea of a Connectivist course, as I mentioned, is that it's distributed. People are expected and requested to participate, and typically they don't participate in a central environment, but rather they would participate by posting their own comments or their own reactions or their own materials on their own website. Typically that would take the form of a blog. And so we are doing here what we would ask students to do. We are posting materials on a regular basis on our own blog. That wasn't a very good ding, but now I'm on to Course Moodle Forum. For those who do prefer a more structured environment, that is provided as well. The idea of Connectivism isn't to favor one environment or another environment, but rather to offer the broadest choice of environments possible. And so we've structured a Course Moodle Forum inside the Moodle environment and taking advantage of the Moodle platform's discussion forum capacities. That's better. Next slide, PageFlake site. Again, the idea here is that the content of the course is distributed, so what is going to be necessary is some sort of aggregation or roll-up of the content from different sources. Here we have a PageFlake site. This is a PageFlake site from the Connectivism course, but again, the same concept applies to the Critical Literacies course, where we're bringing in content from multiple locations and displaying it in a single location. One of the things that George and I found was very useful was the hosting of regular synchronous events online. We hosted, oh, that's my famous clock going off in the background. Sorry about that. We hosted discussions in Illuminate in the Connectivism course. In the Critical Literacies course, we are attempting to install and configure an open source platform. I've forgotten what it's called, although I'll look it up in the question period if anyone is interested. I think it's Open Chat or Open something. It's a fairly major install, so I've sort of been putting it to the back of my mind because it is going to be a bit much. But I mean, Illuminate is really good for this sort of purpose. The problem is it does cost money, and we don't have any money to offer this course, so we have to have some other sort of solution. We expect people to be taking part in a wide variety of back channel discussions and offline discussions, and hence the use of Twitter and similar instant messaging tools. I like Twitter for a bunch of reasons. One reason is that we can aggregate using RSS feeds Twitter comments as well. In the Connectivism 2009 course, by the end of the course, we were aggregating not just blogs, not just forum posts, but Twitter comments as well. All this was brought together into a single feed. This is relevant because the next course component, the daily, proved to be the thread running through all of these distributed materials that participants in the course found to be the most valuable. The daily is where we took these aggregated RSS feeds, put them all together, and sent them out on a regular basis. So again, at the end of the 2009 course, the daily had posts, had Twitter, it had discussion feeds, and even more. And so the daily actually became a very comprehensive resource. One of the features of a Connectivist course typically is that there is much, too much material for anybody to read. And this is deliberate and expected. The idea here is that we ask people to look over the material and pick and choose the things that they find may be interesting to themselves. We want people in the course to have a different perspective, each person to have a different perspective on the material, to look at different things, to bring their own point of view into the mix, because it's by having these different perspectives that having a conversation results in new learning and results in new knowledge that is created from the multiple points of view. So the daily facilitated this. It presents a lot of content in a very compact environment and in such a way that people can pick and choose over the content as it's convenient for themselves. In order to manage the content for the daily, I used a system called Grasshopper, which is something that I wrote myself. The project that Rita and I are working on is called Plurn. It's a personal learning environment application, or actually a set of applications. And basically, a big part of its functionality is to go beyond what was done in Grasshopper. So what we've found is the use of a personal learning environment is recommended not simply for taking or consuming online learning resources. I don't like the word consuming, but I'll use it for now, but also for offering or delivering a course in the Connectivist model. So the same tool that helps learners learn also helps teachers teach. And I think that's actually a fairly significant thing. The next slide on feed harvesting, this is a view of Grasshopper harvesting feeds. Those are actual feeds there from the Connectivism course. And as you can see, there's a large number of different feeds that were aggregated. And what I liked about doing it this way is it was all automated for me. I would produce an issue of the daily each morning, and it would take me less than half an hour to do. And in fact, that half an hour was mostly me just reading stuff because I was interested. The actual putting together of the newsletter was done all automatically. My system harvested the RSS feeds, combined them into a single resource, and then published them automatically in the daily. So the next slide here, you just see an intro screen. And this is how we introduced the course. We found that it's very necessary, especially at this point in time, to outline how the course proceeds for people. Because typically right now when people take a course, they're expecting lecturers to lecture, books to have content, and them to memorize. And a Connectivist course is very different. As I mentioned, there's the large body of material that they're not expected to read, much less memorize, and the discussions and all of that. And so it's really important to outline the teaching method at the beginning of the course. Once that happens, of course, the students can take over and construct the course for themselves. In the Connectivism course, one of the first things that they did is construct a map of the course. From this map, you can see how the Connectivist style of course is not linear, but rather consists very much of a network of interconnected resources. The other nice thing about students in an open course is that they can come from anywhere in the world, which makes this to a certain degree a very equitable course offering. The connective is, of course, as you can see, we had students from almost everywhere in the world. Everywhere there was an internet connection, certainly. And we expect this to be the case for the critical literacies course as well. Add to the map video, and students even created resources like this video describing how to add yourself to the course map that I just showed in the previous slide. That's the nice thing about this kind of course, is that students take over the teaching of the course. We found in Connectivism 2009 that many of the students that were in Connectivism 2008 returned, and when they returned, it wasn't just to take the course again, but it was actually to bring their perspective into the mix and even to begin teaching it for themselves, which was quite remarkable. Here's another example of students taking things into their own hands. People created their own Google groups from the course. Here's another example. This was the Connectivismo Spanish translation of the course material. In the first version of Connectivism, we actually had three separate groups in Spanish, one from Latin America and the other two from Spain, all doing their own thing related to the course. It was quite a remarkable thing to do. This solves lots of problems for us. In traditional discussions of online learning and learning objects and all of that, there's a lot of discussion about localization and how hard it is to localize, much less translate. Here, we simply offered the materials and the space and the facilities online, and people localized it for themselves. And when people localize their own material, there are a lot more to get that localization right. The students did many things with the material. They set up a Second Life area. They set up Digo, I don't know how that's pronounced, and Delicious Feeds. They used WordPress for their own blogs. A whole pile of things. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the learning theory that's involved in this course. And it begins with a process of social construction. And the idea here is that while people are working in this collaborative environment, or as I would prefer to style it, this cooperative environment, what is happening is that they are creating social artifacts. They are creating their own representations of their experiences of the course material. Now, a lot of time people at this juncture jump from social construction into something like constructivism, social constructivism, collaboration, and social creation of a common resource or a common understanding. In a connectivist course, this is not a requirement. In a connectivist course, people have their own individual perspectives and their own point of view. Yes, there is a common learning that is produced as a consequence of this interaction, but this common learning is not a property of any individual's learning. The individual does not necessarily absorb or create this common learning. Each individual learns their own way, as well as being able to observe from their own perspective whatever is produced or whatever emerges as a result of the group collaborations. That's an important element of a connectivist. Personal knowledge, which is what I believe is the result of personal learning, is not constructed. It is not made. It's more like a matter of organic growth. What's happening here is that a person who is taking part in a connectivist course is not absorbing, not remembering, not even creating content, but they're doing something more like exercising. They're doing something more like developing their own capacities rather than inputting, absorbing, or remembering. That's why I like to think of a personal learning environment, which is the tool for accessing a connectivist course, more like an exercise machine. Connectivist courses are intended to address complex domains. as compared to complicated domains. A complicated domain is made up of many small parts, and you understand it by analysis. A complex domain, by contrast, is made up of parts that are mutually dependent on each other. It's made up of networks where individuals impact and change the state of other individuals. You can't analyze it, because if you break it down into parts, you miss out on understanding how one part affects and changes the state of another part, which in turn changes the state of the first part. What you have to do in a complex system in order to understand it is to immerse yourself into that domain or into that field. And so the idea here is that a personal learning environment like Grasshopper or Plurn is intended to help you immerse yourself. And a connectivist course is a mechanism of creating a community that allows people who are interested in that subject matter to immerse themselves into that community. And then once you're in that community, you simply practice by taking part in that community. And your learning is the personal growth that takes place as a result of that practice in that community. This is a model that borrows heavily from the idea of constructionism. And constructionism, of course, as made popular by people like Seymour Papert, is the idea of learning by manipulating materials. And learning here isn't the absorption of the semantic content of that material, rather it's the development of an individual or personal neural structure as a consequence of manipulating that material. Learning is not transferred or translated or anything like that. It is rather induced. So here in the next slide is a diagram of constructionism from the Papert perspective, where in this case constructionism is approached as a matter of a person working with a computer or a computerized environment in order to create artifacts which may be empirical or pseudo-empirical abstractions. That's a fairly narrow view of constructionism nonetheless, that does strike at the heart of what we're trying to do with a connectivist course. The model also ties in and follows the perspective of Pablo Freire or Ivan Illich, the idea that students are expected not simply to learn in some sort of artificial domain, but to work with problems that they really find in the world that are challenges to themselves, to respond to those challenges and actually form their own solutions to the problems that they find in their lives. It's appropriate that this sort of discussion is taking place on Earth Day, because there's a certain overlap between the two concepts. So as I said, the learning in a personal learning environment is about developing capacities, not competencies or skills. And I'm going to talk in a few minutes about the frame for critical literacy. And it's important to think of the elements of this frame not as competencies, not as skills, but as capacities. You're not acquiring some knowledge or skill as though you're receiving it like a gift or a present, but you're building up this there's almost like these critical muscles, if you will, in your own mind by working over problems, working over interactions online, and through that working over, you're developing your ability to work in these complex domains. So what happens is that the learning takes place through the manipulation of the different conversation, the different semantic elements, but again, the learning isn't a retention of the semantic elements, it's simply the manipulation. And the idea is that we create networks, much like the network depicted in this diagram here, we create networks in our own mind that result from the manipulation of hypotheses, theories, simulations, etc. So here's the frame for critical literacy. It's based in part on a course that I taught many years ago and a resource that I produced called Stephen's Guide to the Logical Fallacies, and also in part on work that I've done since then. It's just a system of categorization. I'm not representing anything underlying or essential with this. But there are basically six major elements. Each of these major elements informs one of the four major forms of discourse. And it's not on the slide here, but the four major forms of discourse are arguments, explanation, description, and definition. And at some point, I'll actually describe this in much greater detail. Well, at some point during this course. So just to look at these six very briefly, the first of these is syntax. And by syntax, I'm talking about not simply rules of grammar, not simply things like archetypes, but the structures, the patterns, the regularities that we see in all forms of communication, verbal communication, artistic communication, and the rest. This extends to include things like similarities. And if you're really interested in this, you can look at the work of people like Amos Tversky. And similarities underlie associationist forms of inference. The second frame is semantics. That's theories of truth, meaning, purpose, goal. There are many ways of doing semantics, and it's important that people understand that truth and reference can be determined, described, shaped, and structured in many different ways. A lot of people work with what might be called a naive correspondence theory of truth that doesn't really withstand a scrutiny. And so people should understand that there are different ways of approaching truth, and that the ways of approaching truth often inform to us what counts as being truth. The next frame is pragmatics. This is the commission of actions or having an impact with our critical content. The master of this, of course, was John Austin's Speech Acts, where there are, to use Searle's categorizations, assertives, directives, commissives, etc. But there's a whole host of ways of doing actions, taking actions with content, with words, with images, drawings, etc. Heidegger and his discussion on interrogation and the whole philosophy of meaning as being expressed by use, as described by Wittgenstein. The important thing here that we want to draw out to people is that communication isn't just about exchanging meaning, it's about taking action and changing the world. Cognition is the actual set of reasoning, inference, and explanation that becomes possible through the manipulation of various content objects and is mostly in the area of argument and explanation. But these are these four types of reasoning that I talked about: description, definition, argument, and explanation. Context, sometimes localization, sometimes placing within an environment or a frame of reference. Again, there are different ways of restricting the domain of discourse and applying it to a particular place. And there's been a lot of interesting work that's been done by different people. And again, we want to get across the idea that there's not such a thing as an absolute meaning, an absolute reference, that very often what is said depends on points of view. And points of view are not just perspectives, but the contemplation of what the possible alternatives are. It's not here on the slide, but when I think of this, I think a lot of the de Bono stuff, believe it or not, on creative thinking. You look at de Bono and they're saying things like, consider all the alternatives, look at things from a different point of view. That's context. Understanding that there are different points of views and ways of looking at things from different points of views is an essential element of critical literacies. And then finally, the last is change, and that's something for the 21st century, because previous centuries didn't really have to deal with change the way we have to deal with change. Although that said, there's a history of discussions of change from prehistory, from the I Ching to logical relation to historicity in Hegel and Marx, to directionality, to impact, as McLuhan describes, through progression, the logic of games, point and branch, flowcharts, databases, scheduling. All of these things discuss a world that isn't the same from point to point, and how we navigate from one point to the next. And again, having this sense is essential to being able to navigate a complex literary environment. So these are the six frames that we're going to attempt to discuss in the critical literacy course. These are six frames that, as I would argue, are essential to being able to work in a connectivist environment. And again, I want to underline and emphasize, these aren't skills or capacities. These are more like ways of life or ways of being. It's not like knowing how to understand, the context or the change. It's more like the feeling of context and the feeling of change that we want people to be able to experience and to understand. So finally, this describes the PLE pedagogy. These six frames are the elements of the language, where language is construed very widely to refer not just to text, but to any communicative artifact. And these six frames are used to communicate between individuals and the community. As I mentioned, learning in a PLE involves immersion in this community and a reflective awareness and understanding of the feeling of awareness of these six frames. And that's my cat's tail going by in front of me again. And that is the end of the presentation portion of this. And I hope I didn't go too long. It looks like I went a little long, but I kept it pretty brief, Timu, so I hope it was okay.
I hope you have some time over here. I think we could spend 10 to 15 minutes for discussion and questions. Is there someone who would like to start? Come over here and ask a question, and then I have one simple question and one maybe a larger question. But first of all, how many students are you expecting to this new course?
Oh, that's a miserable question. I honestly don't know. If I took previous example as a guide, I'd be looking at something in the range of 400 or 500. But the topic, which is critical literacies, goes outside the domain of things that I usually talk about in the community that I usually talk to. So there may be less interest because of that, or there may be much more interest from communities I've never reached before. So I honestly have no good expectation. It could be anywhere from 30 to 3,000. But the thing is, anywhere in that number would still be okay. You know, it's like the encores, right? The number that shows up is the right number to have shown up.
It sounds really, for me, more like graduate studies or even higher level, what you described now, a bit of the content. In which level, in more traditional educational setting, it would locate?
Well, you can hear this, right? Yes. Sorry, I'm going back and forth so I can try to record the question as well as my response. That's a really interesting approach, because one of the things that I'm noticing with the connectivist approach is that a course doesn't address a specific level or domain of knowledge. If you look at the connectivist course, for example, we had people who were complete beginners in connectivism, and we had people who were experts in connectivism. And they all take the same course at the same time, and what distinguishes them is the material that they pursue, the material that they find interesting. It would be important when we market, and I don't want to say market, but you know what I mean, when we market this course, it will be important to be clear that this course can be useful to people who are beginners in this and who are experts, and then to make sure that we've provided access to a range of materials. I'm presenting it here at a fairly high level, when I present things like syntax to somebody who's very new to this field, I'm going to present it very, very differently. So there is no level in a connectivist course. It's a hard concept to get at, but I think it's important.
I think that's really, really interesting answer you just gave, because I relate that to the pedagogical approach very much as well. And what Rykotsky talks about, the zone of proximate development. You learn the best when you learn a bit of better students than what you are, or in case of children, a bit elder children. And they pull you to the new levels. So basically, I think kind of in that kind of learning, all the courses should be never defined that in what level they are implemented. They should be open for anybody, and then you come and there's different levels of way of and everybody will benefit out of that as this heterogeneous group of people.
Yeah, that's quite right. I've always thought it odd, just to reduce this to a bit of a slogan. You know, the way we do learning now, at least here, we take a bunch of, say, sixth grade students. We put them in a class of sixth grade students, which means that we're giving them sixth grade students as role models. And it would make more sense to give them older people, more experienced people as role models, and not each other.
Yeah, that's right. Do you have Hans a question? Come over here.
Hi, it's Teemu's colleague Hans. I would like to ask about the tools that are used in these massive open online courses. So you showed us your own RSS reader that you use for reading the blogs and compiling this daily post. What do you think, what are the most important missing features from your own reader and other RSS readers that are currently available that would be important for following this kind of massive open courses?
What are the most important features?
Yeah, that are missing that you would need.
Yeah, okay, I think I get what you mean. I find that, and this is the reason why I'm engaged in the development of a PLE tool of my own, I find that none of these tools take us through from beginning to end of the creative process. RSS readers typically are really good at aggregating, although they are limited to what they can aggregate to RSS and Atom feeds, and they don't aggregate data that is not a part of those feeds. So, and I think we should be aggregating many different types of data and not just, you know, blog feeds or Twitter feeds. So, but these feed readers are not so good at providing us with an environment to work with, to relate and associate content from different areas and to publish. You know, we go back to Dave Weiner's Frontier Userland tool, which was as much a publishing tool as an aggregation tool, and that was probably more in line with the direction that I would want to take with an RSS reader than the direction that has been taken. You look at Google Reader, and you have this very sort of, you know, feature limited content and share capacity, really to the point of almost nothing more than like, dislike, and there's virtually no way to bring things from separate feeds into a single environment. Yahoo Pipes, by contrast, is a very powerful tool to allow you to do that, but it's a terrible feed reader. You couldn't possibly use it just, you know, as an aggregator, because, you know, it's complex to work with. And again, there's no editing and publishing capacities, really. So none of these tools offer the beginning to end kind of content manipulation, content aggregation, manipulation, and syndication features that are needed. And that's really why a development is needed at this point in time.
I think Hans is actually developing the EduFeeder in my group, which is looking for, like, exactly the course you've been working on and how I've been making a joke that actually it's a course management system for open educational courses. It even looks like that now, but making a more like a simple design for people to start up courses like this. But that's another question that, what do you think, how this will scale in future? How big movement this will be that people will run courses like yours?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a history. You know, it's not like George and I began this. It's not even like David Wiley began it with his Open Wiki course. I remember in the early days, the pre-web days of the internet, people were offering email courses. And, you know, they'd get thousands of people signed up for their email courses, and they'd send out an email message every day, and then they'd step you through how to program this or how to develop that. These were fabulous courses. So they've been growing for a long time. I think they're going to continue to grow. And honestly, I don't see an end in sight. I think that they can become very popular, especially when the tools are available that helps anyone do one of these. They could become very popular indeed. But again, it's one of these things. You know, you're asking me predict how much, and again, however many was produced was the right number, I guess.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we must stop now. There's another session starting soon. So thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, and I'm sorry I wasn't there in person, but as you know, there was a small incident that happened partway between Canada and Finland, but I really appreciate everybody coming out and taking part in this less than perfect session, so thank you very much.